From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Is one of America's biggest health obsessions misguided? Investigative journalist Thomas Moore says the war against cholesterol isn't backed up by the clinical research. We'll get both sides of the cholesterol debate on this edition of Fresh Air. Also today, veteran traveler George Brown tells us how not to get taken for a ride the next time you fly. He's written a guerrilla handbook for air travelers. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a recording of a rarely heard Mozart opera. And film critic Owen Gleiberman reviews Baby, It's You, now out on home video. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. President Bush has authorized sending troops to the U.S. Virgin Islands to help restore order in the aftermath of Hurricane Hugo. The Coast Guard has begun evacuating people from the island of St. Croix. Meanwhile, Attorney General Dick Thornburg ordered U.S. Marshals and FBI agents to St. Croix. Weather forecasters have issued a hurricane watch for the southeast coast of the United States as Hugo approaches the mainland. A Los Angeles jury today found Richard Ramirez guilty of 13 counts of murder in the notorious Night Stalker case. NPR's Celeste Wesson reports from Los Angeles.
The jury convicted Ramirez on all 43 counts. That includes 30 other felonies as well as the 13 murders. Some of the murders involved special circumstances, which means Ramirez could be sentenced to death. Ramirez is a 29-year-old drifter who says he worships Satan. When he was caught on the street by residents who recognized him from a police sketch, a string of grisly nighttime murders that had terrorized Los Angeles in the summer of 1985 came to an end. The jury deliberated for 22 days. They had to restart when one of the jurors was murdered. Ramirez chose to listen from a holding cell as the jury verdict was read, count by count, in the courtroom this afternoon. I'm Celeste Wesson in Los Angeles.
The federal government is seeking a record $630,000 in civil penalties from Pan Am for security violations. Among other things, the Federal Aviation Administration said that on December 21st, Pan Am failed to adequately screen passengers and bags on Flight 103, which was destroyed by a bomb. NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports.
The government accuses the airline of failing to search 36 high-risk passengers, their carry-on items, and check baggage in accordance with the airline's government-approved security procedure. But the FAA says there is no evidence that any of the security breaches at London's Heathrow Airport or Frankfurt Airport contributed to the downing of the airline. Investigators believe that a tiny plastic explosive was hidden in a radio cassette player packed inside checked baggage. In addition to the violations related directly to Flight 103, the FAA found security violations at Heathrow and Frankfurt airports during a security inspection conducted after the bombing. The FAA says Pan Am subsequently corrected all the alleged deficiencies. The airline has 30 days to respond to the government. Pan Am says the matters raised by the FAA were generally of an administrative, not a substantive nature. This is Wendy Kaufman reporting.
French airline officials said today that a bomb most likely caused the crash of a DC-10 jetliner that exploded in the sky over northern Africa yesterday, killing all 171 people on board. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped more than 3 points to close at 2683.89 and declines narrowly outnumbered advances on volume of 137 million. I'm Frank Stachow in Washington. The White House says it's ready to resume talks with Colombia on falling prices of coffee. NPR's Richard Gonzalez explains.
The administration today released contents of a letter President Bush sent to Colombian President Virgilio Barco. Barco had sought a resumption of talks with the U.S. to revive the collapsed international coffee agreement. State Department spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler.
The president confirmed to President Barco that we are prepared to resume discussions on the agreement with his government at any time. He also expressed hope that a lasting solution which is acceptable to major members and respects market trends can be found.
The coffee agreement collapsed in June when the U.S. opposed discounted coffee prices to countries outside the coffee growing group. The collapse caused coffee prices to fall 50%, which Barco said hurt the Colombian economy and undermined efforts to fight the drug cartels. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
Three members of the Soviet Communist Party's ruling Politburo lost their jobs today. in a reshuffle which apparently strengthened the hands of reformers in the Kremlin leadership. Ukrainian party chief Vladimir Sherbitsky, legal affairs chief and former KGB head Viktor Chebrikov, and agriculture secretary Viktor Nikonov were dropped from the Politburo. The Soviet Communist Party today demanded that nations' troubled republics quiet their growing calls for independence, but promised to grant them more control over their economies. President Mikhail Gorbachev, speaking at the close of a meeting by the party's policymaking central committee, said it was time to strike a determined blow at those who offer us, instead of politics and serious affairs, adventurous platforms. The session was called to adopt a program addressing growing ethnic tensions. A federal judge today refused to dismiss fraud and conspiracy charges against disgraced evangelist Jim Baker. He rejected defense claims that criminal charges violated his right to religious freedom. I'm Frank Stasio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. The medical profession has been waging a campaign against cholesterol. We've been urged to get our blood tested, and if we test high, to try to lower our cholesterol through changing our diet, or if necessary, using long-term drug therapy. High levels of cholesterol in the blood have been linked to plaque in the arteries that can cause heart disease. The anti-cholesterol campaign is being led by the government's National Cholesterol Education Program. But investigative journalist Thomas Moore says this is a misguided effort that is misleading the public. Moore says there's no conclusive evidence that lowering cholesterol can prevent fatal heart attacks. Dieting hardly affects cholesterol levels, and drugs that do lower cholesterol have potentially serious side effects. Moore is the author of a new book called Heart Failure, examining the revolution in heart care. Portions were adapted into an Atlantic magazine cover story titled The Cholesterol Myth. A little later in this program, we'll hear from Dr. Virgil Brown of the National Cholesterol Education Program. First, Thomas Moore. I asked what led him to take on the cholesterol issue.
When you have witnessed heart attack deaths with your own eyes, as I have in researching my book, Heart Failure, it develops a very powerful and compelling argument for prevention. And I decided to change my book proposal and write about the importance of prevention, focusing on how much lowering cholesterol would help you. I went out to the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, and I said, give me your most graphic example of how cholesterol lowering can help save lives. After, you know, my readers being scared by heart attacks, I want to give them something, some hard evidence that will show how they'll benefit. The study they gave me showed almost no benefits at all, and I was just shocked. And so when you start seeing something that flies against what you've been told, you look into it more if you're a person like me.
I've understood that there's been a consensus in the medical profession that there's a connection between cholesterol and the level of plaque in the arteries that leads to heart disease. Are you contesting this connection between cholesterol, plaque in the arteries, and heart disease?
I think there is an unmistakable consensus in the scientific community everywhere that if we observe particularly young and middle-aged men who have elevated cholesterol levels in their blood, that they are more likely to have a heart attack. What is less clear are the very complicated mechanisms by which these lesions or plaques form in our arteries, and the even more mysterious question about when they suddenly rupture or break and cause a heart attack. And there is much less agreement about that whole process and what cholesterol's contribution to it is.
Now, you say that the connection between high cholesterol and heart disease is weakest over the age of 50, and that's in the age bracket where most heart attacks occur.
Yes, I have been trying to sort of urge we keep the cholesterol role in perspective, and we see it clearly in young and middle-aged men. The relationship weakens or perhaps becomes non-existent with age. And after age 50, for example, there's no association with either high or low cholesterol and either longer or shorter life expectancy.
Is there an explanation for why a connection would be weaker after the age of 50 between cholesterol and heart disease?
The reason that the relationship weakens with age is very probably these lesions form slowly in everyone, regardless of what your cholesterol level is. And so by age 60, the people who had lesions forming slowly are as vulnerable as those whose lesions formed quickly at a younger age but are still alive.
But that wouldn't, I think, necessarily be an argument against controlling your cholesterol after the age of 50.
Well, The Office of Technology Assessment looked at sort of all the epidemiological and treatment studies, and it suggests that there really isn't enough evidence to justify treating people over, depends on which study, 50 or 60 years old, because the cholesterol is not a big enough risk factor. There have never been any experiments done to demonstrate benefits of treatment. And so if I see any wave in which I am not perhaps an isolated voice, but hear a growing chorus, it is we're making a mistake in sweeping the elderly into an aggressive program of treating high cholesterol.
Because the damage has already been done by high cholesterol?
Well, I think the answer to this is really saying, look, coronary heart disease is a disease of old age. All of us become more vulnerable to a heart attack as we get older. The 5% of the population that's over 74 years old experiences 50% of all the heart attacks. One of the reasons you don't see much coronary heart disease in, you know, African countries and countries with very primitive diets, for example, is because, frankly, the people don't live long enough.
Well, let's talk about diet and cholesterol. You say that it's really very difficult to lower your cholesterol level by changing your diet, that by eating low cholesterol food, it's not going to necessarily affect the cholesterol level in your blood.
Well, that's true. The relationship between diet and the cholesterol level in your bloodstream is very weak and very indirect. Most all of the cholesterol compounds in your body that are beneficial, like so-called HDL or good cholesterol, and LDL or the more dangerous cholesterol, are manufactured only inside the human body. So it makes sense that the relationship between what you eat and the cholesterol levels in your bloodstream are relatively weak, and it's very difficult to lower your blood cholesterol without making draconian changes in your diet, and even those in large-scale scientific trials have produced disappointing results.
You said that the studies show that there's no evidence that you'll live longer by lowering your cholesterol to 200 or under. But on the other hand, some scientists say these studies weren't set up to measure fatality because the studies are too short-term to measure fatality, but that they do show that there are fewer coronary problems associated with a lower cholesterol level.
Well, this has become a little bit of revisionist thinking, and if there's anything that's sort of come out of the debate so far, it is quite well-intentioned critics saying of me, you're asking us too much to say that we have an effect on total mortality. I have two answers to that question. First, when they started these experiments, most of them were launched about 20 years ago, many of them specifically thought they indeed could affect total mortality, and it is one of the disappointments of the cholesterol crusade that these benefits simply didn't materialize. The cholesterol lowering actually achieved in these trials has been too small to have any hope of affecting the total number of deaths, and in most cases has not even produced enough cholesterol lowering benefit to have a measurable effect on reducing heart attacks in all but a couple of the most successful trials where they have succeeded in reducing non-fatal heart attacks.
Well, I want to talk with you more about cholesterol, but first we're going to take a short break. Investigative reporter Thomas Moore is my guest. He's the author of a new book called Heart Failure, and an excerpt of that book appeared in the Atlantic magazine as a cover story called The Cholesterol Myth, and his challenge to the medical profession about the way they've been treating cholesterol is indeed quite controversial. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Investigative journalist Thomas Moore is my guest, author of the new book, Heart Failure. Let's get back to cholesterol. There's a program sponsored by the Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute called the National Cholesterol Education Program, and they recommend that people whose cholesterol level is over 240 take a drug to lower the cholesterol level, that people whose level is between 200 and 239, they're borderline, and in some instances should be altering their diet, And 200 and under, there's no intervention they recommend.
Can I just make a small
improvement
or modification there? Terry, at 240, what the government recommends today is that you undertake a regimen of medical treatment that, in fact, begins with diet. And probably among those who undergo diet, ultimately, they project only about 1 out of 5 of those people will be placed on cholesterol-lowering drugs.
Well, you said that the failure of this program, this National Cholesterol Education Program, has been worst in the population of people with high cholesterol. Why are you most critical of that aspect of it?
Well, we have three problems with the National Cholesterol Education Program. First, in order to treat those with cholesterol levels over 240, we need to be able to identify who are those people. Our nation's laboratories simply aren't good enough to pick correctly the people who are at risk. It is well known to the officials of that program, and experts will on programs with me have freely admitted that our clinical laboratories aren't up to the job, and maybe 1 out of 3 people who are being referred or treated for high cholesterol may not have high cholesterol. The second part of this program begins a program, and it's not just some dietary advice. The program calls it a program of behavior modification intended to make far-reaching changes in your diet and lifestyle. I feel such changes would be fully justified if they had scientific evidence that this would prevent heart attacks. There is no real good evidence out there that you can prevent heart attacks by the type of diets that are recommended today. The trials that have attempted to prove this have almost uniformly been an abysmal failure. So that's my second objection.
Mm-hmm. Let's look at some of the high cholesterol drugs, the anti-high cholesterol drugs currently in use. One of them is called cholestyramine.
Yes. Let me just say that the advantage cholesterol-lowering drugs have over diet is that in large trials, they in fact do lower cholesterol anywhere from 8 to 10%, while diet has had a lower effect. The largest and the most important trial the United States government performed was used that particular drug. It's called Questran or cholestyramine.
Okay. Now, this is a drug that's notoriously difficult to take and digest, so it's people who are on it aren't happy to be taking it. But you say this has only shown a slight decrease in fatal heart attacks from, 8% to 7%?
Well, and here's a case of where you get cholesterol hype versus a more balanced perspective. The number of people, there was a control group who took a placebo, which wasn't quite as harmless as it should have been, and then there was the group that was taking the actual drug. The difference was that 8% of those in the control group experienced heart attacks, 7% of those who were treated. Another way of saying this is that to prevent one heart attack, taking these results literally, you would have to treat 68 people for 7 years at a cost of $700,000. I regard that as a very disappointing result. They regard this as conclusive proof that up to 5 to 10 million Americans should be placed on this drug.
When you say heart attacks, do you mean fatal heart attacks?
Non-fatal heart attacks. There were no deaths prevented in this trial at all. The number of deaths between the two groups were similar.
Now, again, people who support this study would say that the study wasn't necessarily measuring fatal heart attacks, that it's too much of a short-term study to measure that, but it's measuring other expressions of heart disease.
Well, let me tell you why I keep hammering at the total mortality or the life expectancy question. It's not to make life difficult for them. It is because there's one particular comparison that is vitally important. It is clear, particularly in drug treatment, that in addition to having health benefits, these powerful cholesterol-lowering drugs can harm health. In the trial of one drug, it was plain after careful measuring of the total mortality that it killed 40 or 50 people. And so the reason why we emphasize total mortality is that if there is a treatment effect here that is large and impressive, you should, and it is conducted in a population about half of whom should die of heart attacks, meaning that the threat of heart attack death is very high, not that half of them are going to die, you should see a result on total mortality. And when they say, oh, it would take many, many more years and much larger trials, what they are really saying is that the effect we have discovered so far of cholesterol lowering is very small. It's simply another way of saying the same thing.
Now, Newsweek recently quoted a University of Southern California research study related to cholesterol, in which there were researchers divided heart patients into two groups, and with drugs and diet reduced one group's blood cholesterol by an average of 26%. And after 2 years, X-ray showed that the treated subjects had developed significantly fewer new plaques in their arteries than their counterparts, and that 16% had actually improved the condition of their arteries. That sounds like a study that really would refute what you are saying.
Well, I don't think it's a study that would refute what I'm saying. The author of that, Dr. Blankenhorn, points out that the changes he achieved in these arteries were small enough that he hasn't convinced everybody yet. But I might add, this is a promising lead. But I think we need to look at this is a promising lead, and we have to ask ourselves a more complicated question, and that is, why is he doing so much better than these other trials? If giving people cholesterol-lowering drugs make these lesions recede, then all these other drug trials should have produced phenomenally good results. What is he doing differently? Or maybe we need, is it because he got a very large cholesterol-lowering and that's the secret? Is it because we haven't measured the key thing, not are these lesions smaller, but are there fewer heart attacks? There are a lot of questions. I think this is a promising lead, and I don't dismiss it at all. But I think, to be honest with you, this sort of one finding hanging out here when his earlier efforts with more moderate cholesterol reductions didn't show much difference, I think it's too early to say that this is a refutation of everything that I say.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious about what you would like Americans to do differently than what they've been doing. Are you suggesting that people disregard the dietary guidelines that we've become so accustomed to following?
Well, I'm not sure that everybody's become accustomed to following it. I can tell you what my goal here is. My goal here is to get the cholesterol issue back in perspective. This country has gone overboard in cholesterol consciousness, and other countries, Canada and England, for example, have not done so. Elevated cholesterol in young and middle-aged men is a risk factor for heart attacks, and there are going to be people, there are going to be any number of people for whom a serious cholesterol effort, whether with drugs or with diet, may well be warranted. What I think is wrong and where I think the Congress and others need to step in is this massive government-directed campaign that is intended to place a third of us under a doctor's treatment for high cholesterol. There aren't enough benefits for that treatment to justify a program that large. We need to be much more selective.
So in the meantime, are you eating high cholesterol foods?
No, and actually, the last thing you'll hear me say is that I think that you should just go out and eat anything you want. There's a lot of evidence on the table that moderation and a mixed diet is very healthy for you for a whole lot of reasons. I'm trying to combat oversell and overhype here, that you're going to lengthen your life with this cholesterol-lowering diets, that most of you are going to get dramatic changes in your cholesterol level, because I think the scientific evidence shows that won't happen. On the other hand, the time-honored virtue of moderation has proven itself over and over again. I never heard anybody hope to live longer because they let themselves get fat. I never heard anybody even dream of the idea that keeping smoking was going to help them. And this is all good health advice. I'm objecting not to to what is pretty good health advice, but turning it into a regime of very expensive medical treatment under doctor's supervision at government direction.
Okay. Thank you very much for talking with us.
It was a pleasure to be with you.
Investigative journalist Thomas Moore. His new book is called Heart Failure. We called up the National Cholesterol Education Program for a response to Moore's challenge. Dr. Virgil Brown co-chairs the diet subcommittee of their adult treatment program, and he's president of the Medlantic Research Foundation. I asked him to respond to Moore's argument that any correlation between high cholesterol and heart attack drastically decreases after the age of 50.
You see, the problem is that what he says is in part true. But if you look at the subfractions of cholesterol, there are very strong relationships. So the total plasma cholesterol is a summation of good things and bad things, and you have to separate those out. And once you do that, you can see very strong correlations with risk, even in the older age groups.
So the two things you're saying you have to divide it down, that's between the LDL and the HDL, the so-called
that's
good
correct.
Cholesterol and bad cholesterol.
Absolutely right.
So you're saying when the HDL and LDL are added together to give the serum cholesterol reading, that the serum cholesterol reading isn't as accurate a predictor of heart attack as these broken down measures would be, because they cancel each other out?
That's correct, because HDL tends to rise a bit as we get older, and it's the good cholesterol. So the more of that, the better. LDL is the bad cholesterol, and you add those two things, a good thing and a bad thing, together and get the total serum cholesterol, so that you can have what seems to be an average cholesterol value, and because the HDL may be low, the LDL may be a bit above average, and have a high-risk profile based on those two numbers.
If cholesterol is broken down to LDL and HDL, do you have an accurate measure over the age of 50, do you think? Does it still correlate over the age of 50?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. No question about it, in many studies.
Let's talk about treatment.
Okay.
Thomas Moore says it takes a draconian diet to lower your cholesterol through diet, that the most aggressive dieting has seen only a 5 to 7% decrease in cholesterol level, and that really only 1 in 7 people can have an effect on their cholesterol level through dieting.
I really don't know where he got those numbers. There are several studies that have shown much greater reductions in average cholesterol with persistence of that reduction over a 5 to 7 year period. There was a study at the Wadsworth VA Hospital in Los Angeles in which 800 men were divided into two groups. The diet group had a 13% reduction in cholesterol that persisted for 8 years.
Well, let me ask you, you say that you've gotten results of 12 to 13%
average reduction.
Average reduction in cholesterol through dieting.
That's right.
It doesn't seem like a lot to me. Say you have a 280 cholesterol level, you reduce it by 12%. What are we talking about, 25 points or something? I mean, how significant
is that? That's
right,
but a 12% reduction in coronary in cholesterol leads to about a 25% reduction in heart attack rates. And that would mean 150,000 individuals who might have had a heart attack would not have a heart attack at the current rates. That's 150,000 per year we're speaking of.
Thomas Moore is concerned that the tests that measure cholesterol aren't that accurate.
Well, Mr. Moore, I believe, really obtained that information in great part from the National Cholesterol Education Program. One of the panels that was formed at the beginning of the National Cholesterol Education Program was a laboratory panel to address the issue of precision and accuracy in laboratory testing. And over the last 3 years, there's been tremendous progress in increasing that accuracy. Failed to be mentioned in his article. And there are goals set for the nation in terms of improving precision and accuracy. And I think within the next 3 to 5 years, we're going to have reached those very stringent goals set by the National Cholesterol Education Program.
Does this mean that a few years ago, the tests we were getting were really inaccurate and people were being misled by their results?
The laboratory chemistry used tended to overestimate the level of cholesterol. And that's why many physicians thought 300 was a normal cholesterol, because the labs were giving them values that were too high. That has been corrected now for the most part. The precision, that is, most laboratories in our country, many laboratories, would give you the same number if it was done in a well-standardized laboratory, which is the case in most places. The improved chemistry now gives a much more accurate number. And for that reason, the 240 that was considered quite even low in some labs is now a high blood cholesterol.
But it's still not as accurate as you'd like.
No, it certainly isn't. We would like to see precision accuracy improve to the 1 to 2% level, and we're working very hard to achieve that.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you for your time.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Dr. Virgil Brown of the National Cholesterol Education Program. Earlier, we heard from investigative journalist Thomas Moore. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, novelist and journalist Cynthia Ozick tells us why she broke her own rule about not using the Holocaust as the subject of fiction. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The aggravation of flying, the expensive tickets, the long lines, the lost baggage, the bad food. George Brown has ways to avoid some of them. He's a veteran traveler who's just written what he calls a guerrilla handbook for airline passengers. Coming up, we ask for some advice. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a newly released recording of Mozart's comic opera, The Abduction from the Seraglio. And Owen Gleiberman takes a second look at John Sayles' 1983 movie, Baby, It's You. It's just out on home video. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush has authorized the sending of troops to St. Croix in the Virgin Islands after reports that National Guardsmen and police joined prison escapees and others in looting in the wake of Hurricane Hugo. Armed Coast Guard personnel have also gone ashore to help restore order and evacuate vacationers or residents wanting to leave the island. The president also authorized troops to help hurricane-damaged Puerto Rico. Meanwhile, weather forecasters have issued a hurricane watch from St. Augustine, Florida, to Cape Hatteras, North Carolina, urging coastal residents to begin taking precautions. Hugo could come ashore late tomorrow or early Friday. French military officials are sending more men and material to a remote site in the African desert where the wreckage of a French jetliner was found. The DC-10 crashed yesterday, killing all 171 people on board. The plane was on a flight from Chad to France. Roger Moyer reports.
More and more attention is now being focused on what caused the DC-10 jetliner to fall out of the sky with such force that the plane's wreckage scattered over 40 square miles of desert. UTA, the French airline company, says its plane was in good mechanical condition and that the pilot signaled all was normal during the flight. The company says it appears a mid-air explosion ripped the plane apart, and it's unlikely the explosion was caused by structural defects. A company spokesman says the disaster seems similar to one in Lockerbie, Scotland, last December, when a bomb destroyed a Pan American jumbo jet. The remote and rugged nature of the African crash site makes it hard to get to, but this evening 40 more French paratroopers were dropped at the site, and they have started to collect the bodies of the victims for removal. For National Public Radio, this is Roger Maurier in Paris.
Israeli warplanes attacked Syrian-backed Palestinian positions south of Beirut today. Chris Hedges of the Dallas Morning News reports from Jerusalem.
Four Israeli fighter planes fired missiles at tunnels used by Ahmed Jibril's Palestinian faction 12 miles south of Beirut. Israeli officials said the planes attacked a command headquarters of the Jibril group. The airstrike was the fourth this year against Jibril positions. Jibril's group, which does not belong to Yasser Arafat's Palestine Liberation Organization, has been linked by Western diplomats to the downing of the Pan Am plane over Scotland last year. Israeli warplanes have made a total of 12 cross-border raids this year. Palestinian sources say the strikes have killed 30 people and wounded 117. For National Public Radio, this is Chris Hedges in Jerusalem.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down almost 3.5 points to close at 2,683.89 on volume of some 137,500,000 shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. A new recording of a 1961 live performance of Mozart's comic German opera, The Abduction from the Seraglio, has just been released. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says it's one of Mozart's most melodic works.
Except for the Magic Flute, Mozart's best-known operas are in Italian. But before his series of Italian masterpieces, The Marriage of Figaro, Don Giovanni, and Così fan tutte, Mozart wrote a great comic opera in German, Die Entführung aus dem Seraglio, The Abduction from the Seraglio. Mozart was 26 years old, already a master, and at the very beginning of his greatest period. Like The Magic Flute, The Abduction is not strictly an opera. In Germany, it's called a Singspiel, a song play, with spoken dialogue instead of operatic recitative between the complex musical numbers. We might call it a musical comedy. Both the abduction and the magic flute take place in the mysterious Middle East. Both have rulers who at first seem wicked and harsh, but who turn out to be benevolent. Both mix the comic with the serious. But the abduction has a much more conventional plot. The noble heroine, Constanza, and her earthier maidservant, Blonda, are being held captive in the Pasha Selim's harem. Constanza's noble lover, Belmonte, and his foolish servant, Pedrillo, come to rescue them. Here's Erwin Wolfhard singing Pedrillo's charming serenade about a captive maiden and a heroic rescue. It's the signal to start the actual abduction from the Seraglio. Though both works have profoundly serious music, the balance is different. The Magic Flute is essentially a serious work, the abduction essentially comic. The character of the Pasha, for example, only a speaking part in the abduction, developed into the great bass role of the wise priest Sarastro in the Magic Flute. The richly comic character of Osmin, the overseer of the harem in the abduction, dwindled from major to minor character in the Magic Flute. Here's the bass Georg Litassi singing Osmin's comic effusion of malicious joy at the vision of a noose around the necks of his captives.
Hüpfen will ich, lachen, springen und in Freuden mich singen, denn nun hab ich eure euch Ruh, denn nun hab ich euch Ruh. Oh, wie will ich triumphieren, wenn sie ein zum Ring was fühlen, und die Käse schnüren zu, schnüren zu.
This performance was recorded live in Salzburg in 1961. The conductor is the Hungarian István Kertész, one of the finest younger Mozart conductors of the mid-century. He died in 1973 in a drowning accident at the age of 44. The other major reason to hear this recording is that it preserves a splendid live performance by Fritz Wunderlich, an appropriate name for one of the most beloved tenors of the century, who also died far too young, at 33. His glistening, fresh voice is ideal for the part of Mozart's impassioned Belmonte. Listen to his opening aria, in which he arrives at the Pasha's seacoast palace looking for his beloved Constanza, which also happens to be the name of the woman Mozart married not quite 3 weeks after the premiere of the abduction.
Hier soll ich dich denn sehen, Constanze, dich mein Glück. Lass Himmels geschehen, gib mir die Ruh zurück, gib mir die Ruh. Nun freuen, bringe mich ans Ziel und bring.
The other performers are pretty good, though the sopranos tend to squeak on the high notes. But this recording is primarily a valuable memento of two wonderful Mozartians, whose brief lives unhappily imitated the brevity of the great composer's own.
Lloyd Schwartz is the classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Mozart's The Abduction from the Seraglio on the Italian label Movimento Musica. This is Fresh Air. Several years ago, George Brown set up an investment banking firm that kept him in the air between San Francisco, New York, London, Frankfurt, Tokyo, and Sydney. He says he's logged over 1 million miles in air travel. Brown's acquired survival skills are collected in his new book, The Airline Passenger's Guerrilla Handbook, Strategies and Tactics for Beating the Air Travel System. He offers advice on everything from finding the cheapest airfares and accumulating frequent flyer miles to beating jet lag and avoiding being sucked out of airplane doors. I asked George Brown about a flying concern of mine. How do you avoid getting stuck with a non-refundable ticket?
You shouldn't worry quite as much about non-refundability.
Mm-hmm.
There are things that you can do. For example, technically the tickets shouldn't be transferable to other people. But the airlines don't really enforce this provision, at least on domestic flights. They don't check your identity when you come in with a ticket. On international flights, they have to check your identity because of the passport.
Passports, yeah.
That's right. And if you look in the back of the Sunday paper, you find there's a lot of people advertising non-refundable tickets that they don't want anymore for sale. And the surprising thing is that if the 21-day advance purchase date has elapsed, you can actually sell your non-refundable ticket to somebody for more than you paid for it, because their alternative is to buy a much more expensive ticket because the 21-day advance purchase period has already elapsed. Also, the airlines will allow refundability or at least switching flights in many situations if you've got a good reason. At some airlines, if the person you're flying with is ill, or if you're ill and you have to get a doctor's certificate on this, or if somebody dies that you're flying with, or if you have a legal requirement that you've been subpoenaed in court or that sort of thing, or you've got jury duty, the airlines will allow you to get a refund or to cancel. In addition, many of the airlines now have introduced new fares, which they will allow you to change one leg of your trip for no payment or a nominal payment.
When I fly, I'm always terrified that I'll never see my clothes again. You know, that I'll take my baggage and like that'll be it.
I assume you mean the clothes in the bag. Right?
Oh, exactly. But do you have any methods of either making connecting flights or checking your baggage to help ensure that you'll see it again when you arrive?
Sure. The best way not to lose your bag is to never check it. And I don't check my bags. I'm on a 5-week tour now in this book, and I'm traveling purely with carry-on. And I think anybody can travel with carry-on if they take a little planning. You just don't want to get stuck in what I call the tragedy of checked luggage. You know what I mean? You've seen these people staggering through the airport with more bags in hands, you know, looking for a check-in line that's less than 250 yards long, you know, or they're waiting up half the night in the baggage claim, you know, waiting for the mechanical luggage eater to puke up their half-destroyed bag, you know. Or maybe on a flight from London to New York, they discover that their bag's been routed by way of Waco, Texas, which one person I talked to actually had that problem. And they finally got their bag back 3 weeks later, and it had all these custom stamps, you know, it had gone all over the world trying to find where they were. But that's the first thing. Don't check your bags. And I think it can be done. Most experienced travelers don't. They travel with an underseat suitcase and a garment bag, and that's good enough for anything.
Okay, say, though, you're taking a connecting flight.
Mm-hmm.
Would you feel more concerned that you'll be losing your baggage on that connecting flight than you would if you were just taking one plane?
Sure, and also on an inter-airline connecting flight, you're much more likely to lose your bag than on an online connecting flight.
Mm-hmm.
Because you've got different baggage systems, and the baggage handlers are supposedly less concerned about bags going to other flights than their own.
Have you ever been bumped on an overbooked plane?
Oh, sure, yeah.
How does that work? It's never happened to me.
It hasn't, huh?
No.
Well, you only have...
I don't get to get away that often.
It's about 1 out of 500 chance that you'll be bumped on average. You can increase your chances by going after those airlines who overbook. That information is published by the DOT each month, you can tell. When you look at who's been bumped, both voluntary and involuntarily, they'll tell you how they're overbooked. It's a difficult thing to avoid. I mean, the easiest way to avoid it is to, one, get a pre-assigned seating. That'll give you priority over everybody else. And a pre-issued boarding pass. The second thing is to get to the airport early if you're concerned about the flight being full.
For those of us who like to have as much room to ourselves as we can get, you have some, I think, cunning tricks for making sure the seat next to you is empty.
Yes, some of them are probably a little too devious, but the first thing to do is to look how planes are filled up. In the old days, they used to fill planes, scattered passengers throughout the planes. And then some airline did a study and discovered that really the only people who benefited by this were the passengers, so they immediately abolished that practice. So now they tend to fill the planes up from the front to the back, cramming everybody up front unless you specifically ask. So the back of the plane will be less likely to be filled than the front, so that's the first thing. The second thing is the center section of a wide body is less likely to be filled. It would be filled last, so you're more likely to get space there if you get an aisle seat in the center section.
This is because people like window views?
Yes, inexperienced passengers particularly like window views. Experienced passengers like the aisle. Because the aisle, you can get your bags, get out fast, and get up quickly without having to stagger over everybody else. Apart from that, if you ask your travel agent, they should have which seats have been blocked out on the plane for staff, for airline staff. And these are usually fairly empty because the staff are up and about serving passengers. And if you can sit next to staff, that's a good one.
This is one of the great mysteries to me when I fly. What do you do when you need the restroom and one of the stewardesses or stewards is serving and they've got this huge tray that takes up the whole aisle and you need to get by?
Well, gee, I don't have any problem getting by.
You don't?
I guess I'm skinny, I guess.
Gee, you must be like rail thin.
Oh, yes, that's right. Yeah. Well, actually, if you just go up close to them and step into one of the rows, they'll push it by for you.
Oh, well, that's clever. I'll get up more often now.
Just to be more assertive. Yeah.
You have some suggestions for how to make your flight comfortable. For instance, you say drink water instead of carbonated beverages or alcohol.
Yes, that's right. There are a lot of things about what you consume on a plane that have to do with the unusual environment, a very unsafe environment of the atmosphere of planes. Because of the air is taken in from above the clouds, there's very little moisture in the air in the plane, and so it's very dry. Usually 2 to 5% humidity, and most of that comes from people perspiring and also breathing out moisture from their lungs. So you want to take things that don't dehydrate you, and that means avoiding salt and avoiding diuretics like coffee or tea, which make you want to go to the bathroom, make you want to urinate, and it's also a problem because you want to have to keep getting up all the time. In addition, the other major problem with cabin is there's very low pressure, and so you want to avoid things which will bloat you up, like carbonated beverages. You also want to avoid chewing gum, because when you chew gum, you swallow a lot of air, and that bloats you up. Your stomach will expand to maybe 20% bigger than it normally is.
Gee, I've always chewed gum to help my ears, to help the pressure in my ears.
It certainly does do it. There are a lot of ways to stop the pressure in your ears. Some of the weirder ones I've seen, which actually work, to get styrofoam cups and put hot towels in them and then stick them over your ears. And a lot of people find that works. But really the ultimate way to do it, to unpop your ears, is what's called a Valsalva maneuver. Valsalva. And that's what's used by scuba divers when they go undersea. And they, of course, achieve a lot greater changes of pressure than you'll get in an airplane. And basically, simply grabbing the nose, pinching the nostril, and blowing softly with greater and greater pressure until your ear pops. And if one ear pops, then you hold, you release the pressure in one nostril, the opposite nostril, and blow until that other ear pops.
When you're flying, do you choose your flight according to the safety of the airplane or the safety of your seat within the plane?
No.
Why not? With all the plane crashes we've been seeing, why not?
Well, even with all the plane crashes that you've seen, the chances of dying in a plane crash are on any departure that you take are less than one in a million. On average, you're more likely to have been struck by lightning in the last 10 years than to have died in a plane crash. So it's really not worth worrying about. If you do like to worry about things, though, there's certainly certain seats that are safer than others. If you're concerned about dying on impact, then being at the back of the plane is statistically safer. If you're concerned about dying in turbulence, then you breaking your head on the ceiling, then you want to sit over the wing. If you're afraid about being sucked out the door, you'll sit away from the door. If you're afraid about dying of smoke inhalation in a plane, you want to sit next to the door so you can get out, you know. So basically, when you get on the plane, you decide how you want to die, and you choose a seat accordingly. But I don't think it's worth worrying about.
So you don't go for a plane with a better safety record or one, you know, a plane that didn't crash last week?
No. In fact, I tend to go for those planes for two reasons.
Oh, no one will be sitting next to you, right?
That's right. Well, three reasons now. I forgot that one. That's right. They're less crowded. Secondly, they'll drop the price. You know, when DC-10s are attacked, immediately all the prices are dropped, so you can get it really cheaply.
Is that true? Do they do that?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, in order to attract people in. After Lockerbie, Pan Am fares were exceedingly cheap. I just flew over from London, and I flew on Kuwait Air. And people don't fly Kuwait because it's third world, and because the Iranians are always threatened to bomb it because they're holding a bunch of fundamentalist prisoners there. So, you get really very, very inexpensive flights there.
Uh-huh.
So I don't worry about it. Oh, the other reason is I think that when these happen, they immediately start looking at them much more closely, and they're more heavily inspected than any other plane. So you're a lot better off.
George Brown is the author of the Airline Passenger's Guerrilla Handbook, published by the Blakes Publishing Group in Washington, D.C. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, I hear you have an interview with Robert McNamara.
That's right. Robert McNamara, former Secretary of Defense, has written a little book about the vision of the world after the Cold War, and he urges the administration to take advantage right now of an end to the Cold War that he sees the Soviets as offering. We talk about his vision and also about why his vision has changed since the days when he used to be Secretary of Defense. We'll also hear from our reporter Ann Garrels, who's in London nowadays, about all the talk of German unification and why the flood of refugees coming out of the East into West Germany has sparked so much more talk about there being someday one Germany.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Owen Gleiberman has a new home video release to recommend, John Sayles' 1983 film Baby, It's You. Sayles' other movies include Return of the Secaucus 7, Brother from Another Planet, and Eight Men Out.
Back in 1980, John Sayles seemed just about the most promising young filmmaker around. His exuberant end-of-the-60s comedy, Return of the Secaucus 7, had the feel of a glorified home movie, yet that hardly mattered. The film's low-budget shagginess was part of its charm. Still, that was 9 years ago. Sayles has made half a dozen pictures since then, and whenever I see one, he still seems like a promising young filmmaker. He's become a purveyor of liberal message movies, offbeat fables about lesbians and union workers and saintly black extraterrestrials. The budgets are still low, only Sayles films have come to wear their amateur production values like a badge of honor, with one exception. Baby, It's You, which was backed by Paramount Pictures, is a romantic comedy with lots of rock and roll on the soundtrack and a fluid, spacious look to it. In other words, not your typical John Sayles movie. Yet it's his one terrific movie. Baby, It's You is set in Trenton, New Jersey in 1967 and it's about a romance that never quite comes off. Rosanna Arquette plays Jill Rosen, an eager young achiever from a middle-class Jewish family who longs to be an actress. Her beau, played by Vincent Spano, is a dashing Italian delinquent who calls himself the Sheik and thinks he's the next Frank Sinatra, even though he can't sing. This guy is a leftover from the 50s. He's a rebel, a great dresser, and a bit of a joke.
The way I figure it, there's only three people in the world that matter. Jesus Christ, Frank Sinatra, and me.
Frank Sinatra?
Man knows what he wants, and he gets it. Best clothes, best cars, best women. You listen to Sinatra?
My parents do.
They got taste.
Baby It's You is much more than the typical girl falls for boy from the wrong side of the track story. The movie understands that Jill and the Sheik have absolutely nothing in common. Are they in love? Not really. But for a while, at least, the fact that they're so wrong for each other isn't a problem. It just makes the romance seem that much more exotic. In the film's memorable second half, Jill goes off to Sarah Lawrence and discovers a brave new world of preppies having their first fling with the counterculture. For the first time, the class princess has to work to keep up. As for the Sheik, he hightails it to Miami Beach and lands a job at an Italian restaurant lip-syncing to Sinatra records. By all rights, the romance should be over, yet the two can't quite let go of each other.
What are you doing here?
I came to see you.
Sheik.
I want you.
Sheik, I...
Damn it! You shut up and you listen! You never give me an inch! Not in high school, not ever! And we're good together, I know that! Just you and me, that's what's important!
I'm not in love with you.
Baby It's You is one of the rare movies that's not simply about coming of age, but about truly growing up. Jill and the Sheik aren't just holding on to each other. Their real love affair is with the blissful delusions of youth. Rosanna Arquette's delicate performance shows us the dance of caution and curiosity in her character, and Vincent Spano is a revelation. He's not a very expressive actor, but he turns the Sheik's brooding, street-punk intransigence into something funny and surprisingly moving. Together, these two help make Baby It's You one of the very best romantic comedies of the 80s. It's enough to make you wish John Sayles would join forces with another major studio, put his good intentions on hold, and make a real movie again.
Owen Gleiberman is a freelance writer based in Boston. Phyllis Myers, Ed Doherty, and Amy Sallet produce the interviews on Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, novelist and essayist Cynthia Ozick tells us how literature almost kept her from living life. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Bob Dylan's new album. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.